Hey, everyone. Before I jump in, just a quick word to say today's show is about a fast-moving story. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. This is also a disturbing one. There's the sound of gunfire in here. So if you need to pause and listen later, we'll be here when you get back.
We do begin in Russia, where Russia state.
It was Friday night when reports started coming in about a concert outside Moscow that had been targeted by terrorists.
Video showed the Crocus City Hall ablaze before part of the roof collapsed.
At first, all there was were these images of the outside of the mall where the attack took place, a shooting, then a fire. Then came the videos from inside the venue, sounds of gunshots and panic.
We heard gunshots. At first, we didn't understand what had happened, said this eyewitness. Then the terrorists came in and started shooting everyone.
All weekend long, The Washington Post's Shane Harris has been sorting through this evidence, trying to understand exactly what took place.
We're seeing, obviously, a lot of reports via social media, including by people who were in the concert hall when it was attacked. We are hearing from Russian officials who are on the scene investigating it and who are issuing statements about body counts and sort of objective things, and then maybe a separate category of not so objective information. And then also talking to U.S. officials.
Yeah, are all these different sources agreeing on what took place?
No, they're not.
The Americans say this attack has all the hallmarks of ISIS, specifically ISIS-K, a branch of the Islamic State that is based out of Afghanistan.
But what we're hearing coming out of President Putin in Russia, as well as sort of Kremlin-backed or supportive broadcasters and journalists, is an effort to try and blame this attack on Ukraine. Whereas, you know, another important bucket, by the way, I didn't mention of information, is ISIS itself is taking credit for this and has been posting images and posting statements.
Yeah, they have their own news agency, right?
That's right, yeah. ISIS-K first claimed responsibility for the attack in Moscow via their news agency, which put out a statement on social media saying, hey, we did it.
Over the weekend, it's been interesting to me to see this push and pull over responsibility, to see a speech from Vladimir Putin where he avoided saying ISIS had anything to do with this attack. And then within hours, you see ISIS itself releasing gruesome videos shot allegedly by the shooters themselves in the concert venue, almost to prove, like, no, we did this.
Yeah, that's right. It's almost as if ISIS is responding in some way to Putin's unwillingness to give them credit for the attack. Because, you know, part of what ISIS wants here is to undermine Putin and Russia's security apparatus. So if the president of Russia in his public address refuses to acknowledge who actually did the attack, it's not giving ISIS the kind of public relations victory that it was hoping for.
Today on the show, a very public fight over a terrorist attack in Russia and why who gets the blame matters. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by Rocket Money. Do you ever feel like money's just flying out of your account and you've got no idea where it's going? It is all those subscriptions. Think about it. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it is endless. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and helps you lower your bills. you can see all of your subscriptions in one place. If you see something you don't want, you can cancel with a tap. You never have to get on the phone with customer service. They'll even try to get you a refund for the last couple of months. All you have to do is take a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money will take care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/whatnext. That's rocketmoney.com/whatnext. rocketmoney.com/whatnext. Let's start with the attack itself. This was a concert venue, also a mall, called the Crocus Concert Hall, outskirts of Moscow. How popular is this place? Like, what was this place?
Yeah, so this is a big kind of glitzy concert hall and public event space northwest of central Moscow out in a suburb. You know, Sia played there at one point. I mean, other big bands have played there. Folks were there on Friday to see an older rock band called Picnic.
Who's in the audience for this performance?
From what I gather, it was people who've really loved this rock band for years. A lot of people, it's been reported, who are victims, it seems like, were maybe in their 40s. So they're people my age. There are people who had shown up to hear a beloved band in a very popular hall where people go routinely to see big acts perform.
How did the attack start?
Well, from what we understand is that these gunmen basically walk into the event space and then go into the concert hall and start shooting concertgoers, some of them at point-blank range. There have been these very gruesome photos, you know, that show them, you know, killing people. I mean, at one point, I think cutting someone's throat reportedly. They just basically stormed this event hall. And from what we can see from the videos that have been posted, met with no resistance. There wasn't a big security presence at the hall. There weren't, you know, guards there fighting back against them. These terrorists were able to just go in and essentially with free rein terrorize this place, and then appear to spread some kind of liquid, flammable liquid, that then set the concert hall ablaze and ultimately brought down the roof. So it really destroyed this venue, it appears.
How quickly did ISIS claim credit for what had happened?
It was a matter of hours. As soon as I saw reports of this attack, I immediately started contacting sources who, to a person, said, you know, this looks like ISIS-K. You could kind of read the reporting and even see some of the initial imagery and see that this was, you know, this gunman style of attack kind of fit with their MO.
So they have a signature way of going about things?
Well, it's not so much I would say it's a signature, but the idea that you would have gunmen heavily armed going into a venue like this and just shooting people, that struck sources as saying, like, this looks like, you know, a way that ISIS would do this. I mean, trying to cause mass devastation, setting the building on fire. And then, you know, ISIS puts out this statement through its news agency on Friday in the evening, Washington time, leaving, you know, very little doubt, I think, in a lot of officials' minds.
Some people might be confused to hear about ISIS here because, of course, U.S.-backed forces claimed the Islamic State caliphate was defeated back in 2019. The caliphate is an ISIS. But still, I think some people may be surprised to hear ISIS, really?
Yeah, you'd be forgiven if you thought, wait a minute, I thought, you know, U.S. forces killed the leader of ISIS and that this group was no more. What we're talking about here in this Moscow attack is a branch of ISIS that's often known as ISIS-K, which stands for Khorasan. And this is a group that really where their efforts have been focused on is fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan, which they do not see as sufficiently committed to pure Islamic law or Sharia or Islamic rule. So this is kind of an offshoot. It always was a division of main ISIS that really hasn't been destroyed and has actually been quite active. It hasn't gotten the level of attention that, you know, sort of core ISIS got and that the United States was so committed to in its fight, you know, principally, you know, there in Syria and in Iraq. But it's an active division that has been doing a number of terrorist attacks. Folks may remember a few months ago, there was this massive bombing in Iran that killed around, I think, 90 people. That was ISIS Khorasan. In January, there was an attack on a church in Turkey that didn't get a lot of attention. There have been attacks in Russia going back to 2019 by this group. So it's kind of an offshoot that has maintained some strength and appears to be obviously, you know, quite capable still, given the devastating attack in Moscow over the weekend.
I don't understand where Russia and Iran and Turkey come into play if ISIS-K is primarily concerned with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Can you explain?
Yeah, ISIS-K sees Russia as essentially having the blood of Muslims on its hands and is particularly targeting Russia over its support of the regime in Syria. So, I mean, in some sense, ISIS-K even blames Russia for helping to, you know, deny it the caliphate that it wanted. You can go back all the way to, you know, jihadist struggles with Russia in Afghanistan in the 1970s. There is a long-standing kind of feud between Russia and different, you know, militant groups like this. But presently, what ISIS-K really does is sees Russia as an enemy of Muslims and is targeting it accordingly. I mean, it would kind of be in the same way that they would view the United States.
It seems to me like ISIS-K is a group that the U.S. is paying particular attention to. And I say that for a couple of reasons. Like, first reason, like a day before this attack in Russia, U.S. Central Command was warning Congress that ISIS retains the ability and the will to attack the U.S. and Western interests abroad with little or no warning. So that's one thing. It was clearly on someone's mind. But then there was this very specific warning. On March 7th, the U.S. government told Americans in Russia that the embassy is monitoring reports that extremists have imminent plans to target large gatherings in Moscow, including concerts. So tell me a little bit about what your contacts inside the government are saying about ISIS-K and whether they are turning their attention to this group and why.
I think they've never stopped paying attention to it. I mean, you know, when the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan a few years ago, you know, we'll recall that a lot of people who were opposed to that withdrawal said, you know, we need a U.S. presence on the ground to continue monitoring terrorist activities, of which you would put ISIS-K in that group. And sort of the proposal that the Biden administration made was, we think we can do this kind of intelligence gathering and monitoring of potential threats emanating out of Afghanistan and the region without having boots on the ground. Well, this is kind of evidence of that, insofar as the United States did get some degree of intelligence. We don't know exactly how specific it was, but it was fairly specific as to concert halls about what ISIS-K was planning. You know, clearly in this case, there were indications that were pointing back to some group that was either in Russia or was targeting Russia. So, you know, the U.S. pays very close attention to this, even when it's not really in the headlines. And counterterrorism isn't the number one priority of the intelligence community anymore, but it's not a low priority either.
Do we know what was in the intelligence reports that led to that March 7th warning?
Well, we know because we can see the public warning about avoiding large gatherings, concerts. Beyond that, we still don't know. And in talking to, you know, some sources, it seems like it might not have been very, very specific, insofar as, you know, there might have been information that had to be stripped out to protect sources and methods. There's always a concern with that. You know, look, Russia is an adversary country, but the United States does still share information about threats to civilians. The question really, I think, is, you know, to use the intelligence terminology, how actionable was this information? Did it say, you know, the Crocus City Hall is going to be targeted? Or did it say, there are threats against large gatherings at places like concert halls? What we do know is that there was no security around that very public venue. And only a few days ago, Putin publicly was very dismissive of the warnings that the United States and other governments had made, you know, through these public and diplomatic channels, essentially saying they're trying to scare us. It's just false information. So he was really publicly dismissive of the warnings that we know from U.S. officials were shared with his government.
I mean, did the government do anything after receiving this intelligence that we know of?
Not that we know of. I mean, it's, you know, when these kind of, you know, pieces of information are shared, you know, if it's a close ally, you can imagine that they might be a bit more responsive to it. So we don't know whether, you know, Russian security services found this, got this information from the Americans and said, oh, thanks very much, you know, we appreciate this, or just sort of pitched it into the, you know, the garbage can. The question here is, A, whether the information was specific enough to say, go put, you know, guards and reinforce your security at this venue, or whether it was ignored. And if it was ignored, is that because the Russians didn't believe it? The Russians didn't feel it was useful? You know, a more sinister and cynical calculation that we have to wonder is, did Vladimir Putin know this was happening and kind of just thought, well, maybe we'll just let it happen and see what occurs? We don't have any evidence of that. But those are questions that, you know, Ukrainian officials I've been hearing from in the past couple of days are saying as well. They wonder if Putin thought that this would be somehow advantageous to let it occur. There's no evidence of that, but it gives you a sense of how I think Ukrainian officials think that he is capable of doing something, you know, that dastardly.
After the break, Vladimir Putin blames Ukraine. This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Let's face it, sometimes multitasking can be overwhelming. Like when your favorite podcast is playing and the person next to you is talking and your car fan is blasting, all while you're trying to find the perfect parking spot. But then again, sometimes multitasking is easy, like quoting with Progressive Insurance. They do the hard work of comparing rates so you can find a great rate that works for you, even if it's not with them. Give their nifty comparison tool a try, and you might just find getting the rate and coverage you deserve is easy. All you need to do is visit Progressive's website to get a quote with all the coverages you want, like comprehensive and collision coverage or personal injury protection. Then you'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies, all lined up and ready to compare. So it's simple to choose the rate and coverages you like. Press play on comparing auto rates. Quote at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states and situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
As soon as this attack occurred, it seemed like the narrative inside Russia was really pushing people to consider that Ukraine was involved somehow in the attack, as far as I can tell, without evidence. Putin gave a speech where he talked about how there was an open door for the terrorists who had staged this attack and that they were heading to the Ukrainian border.
All four direct perpetrators of the terrorist attack, all those who shot and killed people, were found and detained. They tried to hide and move towards Ukraine, where, according to preliminary data, a window was prepared for them on the Ukrainian side to cross the state border. A total of 11 people were detained.
Tell me more about this connection and how certain actors in the Russian government are trying to draw it.
Yeah, so Putin gives this speech in which he tells people that these attackers, as they were fleeing, were heading towards Ukraine. And he never says Ukraine's behind it, but he also talks about Nazis and their tactics of harming civilians in the occupied territories, which is, I mean, essentially it's a reference to Ukraine. He's in fairly, you know, unsubtle language.
Because he refers to Ukrainians as Nazis.
That's right. He refers to Ukrainians as Nazis. So in this fairly unsubtle way, he is saying to the Russian public, you know, the Ukrainians did this. They put these people up to it. Maybe they hired them. They, you know, the Russians have been putting out video of two of the supposed suspects, one of whom says that he was actually hired to do this. We've seen reporting in recent days of the Russian government telling, you know, state-backed journalists in Russia, go with the line that Ukraine is behind this. And we're now seeing, you know, prominent pundits and newscasters in Russia saying Ukraine did this. Ukraine is responsible for this.
Unarmed men, women, and children slaughtered by terrorists that were sent by Ukraine, that were sent by the U.S. terrorists, the Nazis of the world.
None of that is surprising to me. I mean, when I first saw the news come across, my first thought was they're going to blame Ukraine for this and use it as some kind of, you know, pretext for escalation.
What's the response been from the Ukrainian government?
Oh, that that's absurd. You know, they say, like, we had absolutely nothing to do with this. I was talking, you know, within the first hour of the attack with a Ukrainian official who I just pointedly asked. I said, was your government involved in this? And he responded, be like, why? What would we gain from this? Why would we kill civilians in this way? This does nothing for us strategically. And Ukrainians, including President Zelensky and other senior officials, have been coming out, putting out public statements just in the past 24 hours saying this is ridiculous. I mean, Putin invades our country, slaughters our civilians, and then turns around and blames us for killing his civilians when really it's his weak security and his ineffective security apparatus that let this happen. So both sides are taking rhetorical advantage of this moment.
Yeah. I mean, on Friday, a prominent Russian oligarch called for a nuclear strike on Ukraine. Do you think something like that could actually happen?
I mean, I will say that, in the first hours after this attack, and I think this is probably still true, my great concern was that Putin would use this attack as some kind of pretext for doing something truly escalatory and awful. And because he has openly flirted with using tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine, I mean, I admit my mind kind of went there at first. I think that would be a hugely strategic blunder for him to do. But you have to sort of think about it from his perspective of, you know, he's not going to let a crisis like this go to waste. Is there something that he could do to build the case for some more dramatic kind of action, or possibly to build the case for a mobilization of more forces, which would not necessarily be popular in Russia? But if he could say, look, the Ukrainians are slaughtering people in Moscow, maybe, you know, citizens who actually believe that line that he's peddling might be, you know, willing to go ahead with, you know, the rather unpopular mobilization of forces.
Is there any way to change the information ecosystem inside Russia? Or is that done? Because it really does sound like you're talking about how everyone on TV is now like speaking from the same hymnal here. And we're just not sure what that's going to mean in terms of how Putin takes advantage of this.
Yeah, I think as long as Vladimir Putin is in charge of Russia, there's practically no way to change the stranglehold that he has on information in Russia. There is no way to break Russia out of this disinformation sphere that people are living in. You know, there are independent sources of news about Russia and some operating within Russia, but practically speaking, Vladimir Putin writes the script, and I think that's going to keep happening. It's one reason why the United States government and the intelligence community for a couple of years now have really been very forward-leaning and pushing out information about what they know about Russian activities, things that normally they would keep secret and try to stay in the classified realm, is they're trying as best they can to counter that narrative against Putin. And, you know, in many cases, that's to build support in the West. It's not to try to convince minds in Russia. But if that starts to break through, you know, and it does in the form of people like, you know, Alexei Navalny and other opponents to Putin who speak out, that might start to change the environment. But we see what Putin does to people like Navalny and what he does to his critics. I mean, he has spent a lot of resources on trying to track dissidents, on trying to keep them silent. It seems like he's spending more time doing that than he is trying to monitor for threats against his own people by groups like ISIS-K.
You know, this attack It happened just a week after Vladimir Putin really ran away with the presidential election in Russia. And one of the things that Vladimir Putin promises Russians in exchange for his ultimate control of the country is security. And I was thinking about that in the context of this weekend. You know, the New York Times called this attack a searing counterpoint to Putin's promise. Do you think Russians are going to see it that way?
I wish they would. I'm not optimistic of that because we've seen terrorist attacks in Russia, and opposition to Putin or rejection of Putin does not follow from them. Rather, what happens is you see Putin strengthening his stranglehold on information, implementing more onerous security measures domestically, embarking on foreign adventures like the invasion of Ukraine. You're absolutely right that, you know, the fundamental compact that he is making, the implicit compact with Russians, is, you know, I am a strong leader, I will protect you. It's precisely why when they are hit in this way, in large measure because of the failure of his security apparatus, he rushes immediately to blame someone else for it. He will never accept blame himself. In fact, he cannot accept blame. He has to do everything he can to push the narrative the other way, and if not convince people that his version of the story is true, to at least confuse people to a sufficient degree that maybe they throw their hands up at it. This is what he's done after every attack, and so I don't anticipate this is going to be any different this time.
Shane, I'm super grateful for your time and your reporting. Thanks for coming on the show.
It's always good to talk to you, Mary. Thank you.
Shane Harris, no relation, by the way, is a senior writer covering national security over at the Washington Post. He's also the co-host of the national security podcast, Chatter. And that's our show. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Madeline Ducharme, and Anna Phillips. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the senior director of podcast operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. Catch you back here next time.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.